Welcome to the Northern Business Podcast, a regular discussion with people in the north of England who lead businesses, employ people, and have new ideas to help our economy grow. The Northern Business Podcast is produced by Recognition PR, which serves lots of companies in different sectors around the country. Some are occasionally on this podcast. We're sponsored by Virtue Motors PLC, one of the top automotive retailers in the UK, with a network of dealerships representing some of the world's most popular brands. I'm Graham Robin. In the studio today, we've got Bill Scott, who's the CEO of Wilton Engineering, the Wilton Group. And down the line, we have Jonathan Clements, the CEO of the British Construction Steelworks Association. And later, we'll be hearing from the local, that is the UK-based, managing director of Ducati UK, who've been doing some investments in the north of England, enlivening their network of showrooms. All right, first of all, Bill and Jonathan, welcome to the programme. Bill, Wilton Group, let's remind our viewers and listeners what it is that you make.
In a short summary, we build large, complicated structures, initially for the subsea industry, along with the offshore industry for many years, probably 25 years. Then we moved across into offshore wind, and now we work in defence.
Defence, and also, so there's all sorts of different things that require your big constructions. I was on the top of a big thing that goes on a ship to help the offshore industry build their wind farms a few years ago. The big, big engineering things with metal. And then we've got Jonathan down the line from the British Construction Steel Association. I suppose Bill's kind of business is the kind of business that's your members. Tell us about your members and what your association does.
Yeah, certainly. So we represent construction steelworkers, you said. And that's the steelwork that goes into buildings and civil engineering infrastructure activity in the UK. So we're really taking the steel sections, beams and plates and fabricating them to produce the bridges that we cross. The large structures, as you say, they are used in offshore and onshore energy. And of course, buildings, anything from a warehouse through to a multi-storey commercial office block.
Okay, well, Jonathan, I know you've got a lot of things to say about how policy is affecting your members, but we'll get into them in a few minutes because I want to hear how Bill's company is faring. Now, I know you said you're working in defence and so on. We're not going to go into the contracts there because you've probably got a confidentiality agreement.
Yeah.
But in terms of the growth of your business, which is on the side of a river with old-fashioned, we used to be shipyards, didn't it, where you're located. What kind of employment numbers have you got now, and how is productivity and costs, cost management progressing?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we're just over 300 people currently. We obviously, as well as manufacturing, we also blast and paint everything that we manufacture as well. In terms of being efficient, obviously we have to be competitive. That's one thing. If you're not efficient, you're not competitive. But we actually honed that thing, that very, very important competitive bit and the efficiency bit, was when we moved into the offshore wind industry. So in the large modular manufacturing world, everything was one-off. We never built the same thing twice. So you never got used to actually, you know, harvesting your efficiency doing that. But when you move into offshore wind, of course, there's quantity. So you do the same thing over and over and over again. So we had to have a really good sort of discussion regarding the efficiency with our senior management team. Sat down with the shop floor, supervision, and we all got together to work out how do you do things quicker, better and smarter. And that was a really key thing for us. So is to build the BYTs, which are the big yellow things that we used to do, and yeah, that's how we did it.
Now, many people watching the Northern Business Podcast don't realise the sort of unique area of riverside engineering that you occupy, and in Newcastle and in Teesside, and previously and to a certain extent still in Merseyside and Humberside.
Yeah,
these river engineering companies were always, in the 20th century, they were massive employers building ships, oil rigs, just so. How have you managed to exploit the riverside frontage so that you can constantly innovate your business?
I think the key thing for me was, when I first started the business, which is 30 years ago in 1994, was to understand that if you are by a river, you then actually, you are one of very few companies that actually do things. And I remember working with Sir Michael Fallon, and he asked me, what is your USP? And I said, Sir Michael, that's really simple. We don't deliver by road. So everything we do is we're delivering by sea. That allows us to build bigger, more complicated things. And that was the concept on day one before we had even started.
The buildings that you have by volume are among the biggest buildings in the UK.
Absolutely.
They used to be created oil rigs. Yeah. Fast hangar, but they're bigger than aircraft hangars.
Yeah, they are. The huge business, huge buildings. Fortunately, they're all full at the moment, which is a good thing. But it allows us that flexibility to be able to take projects in of longevity, where you've taken a project in, it might take 1, 2, 3, even 4 years to build something. They are such a scale. I mean, some of them are like 3,000 tons in weight, very, very complex and high skilled.
Now, let's talk in the more general about the economy. You've run the business for a long time. You've got a lot of experience. The government has now made some changes, which all come in April. Now, it occurs to me that you've already priced these projects. You said they're long-term, big-scale projects. The government is now changing the playing field somewhat by its new tax arrangements. How do you feel about that?
Well, I guess that they've made a decision. You can whinge about it. That ain't going to do any good. You've got to look at how you run the business, and you just got to accept it. Yes, they may change their mind later on, but if they don't, then you've got to get on and just either absorb what you can or become more efficient. Look at things. So we're looking at things that will save us man hours in terms of setting things out. So it might take a man, say, I don't know, 40 hours a week to mark something in the office, really, really complicated. But we can use things now. Can't tell you what they are, but we can use things now which actually take those 40 hours away, and it could be done in
so the technologies that are available, you're bringing them forward.
Correct, yes.
So whereas otherwise you might have done it, but the pace of change.
Yeah, it's making us think about what we're doing. You know, I mean, we measure with the lasers now. Yes, we do have tape measures, but we're measuring with lasers rather than with tape measures. And
can I ask this more general question? I might ask this of Jonathan as well, so be prepared. It's just an opinion question. Rachel Reeves at the budget said she was going to raise from the employer national insurance and the change to this around $25 billion. Do you think she'll get it all? Or do you think that employers have made sufficient change that she won't actually get what she thought she would?
Only time will tell, I guess. You know, I think that I know of a lot of small companies that are really struggling with the situation. Certain sectors more so as well, where they either can't pass it on to fundamentally, most people I've spoken to, they're passing it on to the customers.
It's interesting because most people I'm speaking to,
yeah,
maybe it's because we do PR and sometimes we do crisis, are telling me to get ready for announcements of job losses.
Yes.
So it's mixed, really.
Yeah, I think, I mean, at the end of the day, if you've got, like us, we have a project to deliver. So job losses is not on the cards.
Absolutely.
We need more people. We just got to get your head around this. That, you know, basically, I think fundamentally, I think it's going to cost about £1,000 per person per annum. To us, it's like 300,000. So
is this so serious?
It's serious money.
It's money. Yeah, a billion here, a billion there. Yeah. Then we're talking real money. Marks.
Yeah.
What do you think of the answer to my question? Bill was he's a very positive person, by the way, so I think you're fantastic. But do you think Rachel Reeves, Jonathan, will get the money she budgeted for?
I'm going to use exactly the same phrase in time will tell, but I do think that it is for certainly some of our membership, the more that, as you said, the smaller ones, it is a big cost. And if they're in a fixed price contract, which is quite common in construction, it is proving a challenge. Flip side is we face continuous skill shortage. It's always a challenge finding skilled workers. So I don't think you'll be experiencing massive job losses, but I do think the rate of new recruitment is certainly slowing up, and people are pausing as we go into the new financial year about whether to put more investment. But the flip side, you know, there's been a lot of investment in automation, machinery, digitization over the past 6 years. And I think that's starting to reap some benefits in terms of efficiency. You know, more people have started to talk to me about cost to serve in the last 4 months than probably the last 4 or 5 years when things have been a bit better.
Fascinating. And I know in both of your sectors, it's maybe a little bit of a different thing, but where Recognition PR is working with clients that are facing the public, whether it be people on call centers answering phones, people making coffee, people selling things in showrooms, that's where I've seen jobs going and people being asked to do their job with fewer people and more automation. All right. Now, Jonathan, I want to ask you a little bit about some of the issues that your members are facing. We have to touch on the steelworks first, because steel is very important. We've had a lot of change in the UK steel making capacity, and now there are tariffs on the export of steel to America. What's your analysis of how we can weather that?
As a sector, we're distinct and different. You know, the structural steelwork is, you know, we reckon around 60,000 people, 1.6 billion. So we're distinct from the steel mills that make it, but we're obviously very dependent for confidence on the steel sentiment in the marketplace. So, you know, it's never good news when there is bad news about the steel mills, but I think it's very good that we've now got the steel strategy underway, and hopefully one way or another we'll get some clarity.
Now, Bill started his career in steel, didn't you, Bill? What's your view on what I just asked, the way the capacity of the UK to make steel is diminishing and the tariffs to export?
Obviously, it's already in. I think that this whole tariff thing might be something, hopefully it's Dominic Tico, but I'm hoping that, you know, we can negotiate something where, you know, if they're going to put tariffs on us, then we have to, you know, obviously put tariffs on things coming into us as well. But I think from a steel point of view, obviously disappointing news for Teesside. You know, obviously I was expecting electric arc furnaces to be situated here, but you know, at the end of the day, they're in the UK, two of them, I guess. But that's good. But it is worrying. You know, obviously Teesside has fallen. Scunthorpe's taken a hit. You know, Wales is the same. So yeah, it is worrying.
Now, I'm not going to go into what you make in the defence sector, but the defence sector, clearly, if you're making big things, needs steel and metals. And virgin steel is very important.
Sure.
Where do you tend to get your steel? Can you get it from the UK, or do you have to import specialist steel?
Well, when we were building some of the projects which were requesting high-grade steel, that was all coming from Germany. And I believe that all of the steel that we order or for the defence industry is supplied by the MOD / our client.
Okay, well, we won't go into the detail of that. What about you, Jonathan? Your experience from other members, where are they getting their steel? Bill has specialist steel, but if they were doing regular projects, like you've got the girders in a building behind you demonstrating the use of building girders, but we know that they are pressed out on Teesside and they have a great trade in it, but where do they tend to get it?
It is shifting, and it's shifting significantly because of the green agenda. We're certainly seeing around probably 45-50% imports in the structural steel side on the beams and the sections that you can see behind me here. So that's primarily coming from Europe, although we are getting some inquiries from distributors about bringing stuff that's CE marked in from further afield, like Asia. And then on the plate side, it's generally from Europe that stuff is being imported. But yeah, I mean, overall, yeah, it's certainly seen significant impact on the activity coming out of Teesside and Scunthorpe, more because of, you know, trying to address the green steel approach. So you know, the sooner we can have the EAF furnaces in place, the better, I think.
It's heartbreaking, isn't it? I mean, I know that you, Bill, you've been making major components for offshore wind. We're at Teesside, everyone's behind offshore wind. Yet at the same time, do you, like me, sort of breathe a heavy sigh and think, did we go too fast, too far? Is the net zero agenda just not giving everyone the chance to catch their breath and not abandon our industry?
I think, obviously, the steel industry was really vitally important for the not just the Teesside, but obviously for the country. I think that, you know, you've got to look at the positives out of the net zero again. I am always positive, obviously. Net zero, the positives out of that. I mean, it combines a number of large things: carbon capture and storage, blue hydrogen, green hydrogen. You've got battery storage coming in, you've got sea wind coming in at Teesside, plus, you know. So, I mean, you know, and what it does for me is it gives us a flavour of a different type of industry as well. So previously we've suffered from one large industry, i.e. British Steel or ICI. And when a big giant falls, it's really painful. You know, so I think that we were spreading our load, I think, and I think we just got to go with it. It's offering thousands of jobs, you know, so I think that, yeah, we've got to think about the positive side.
And I think, Jonathan, this is what the government would say as well. There's lots to build when it comes to net zero. There are new pylons to build in order to get the energy from these places to the consumers of electricity. There are new wind turbines to build. But your organization has a point of view on who should do this building. Tell us about that.
I mean, yeah, clearly. I think I reflect that there's lots of very exciting infrastructure and construction going on, and it is diversifying and thankfully also diversifying manufacturing, not just industry, because we've seen a lot of us in the services. But you know, what we're very clear on is that, you know, where possible, it should be a UK supply chain in terms of certainly our fabricators. You know, the CBRI produced a report saying, I think it's around £3 is generated for the UK for every pound spent on construction. And what we're seeing is unnecessary decisions taken to bring in fabricated steel from overseas. And, you know, we'd just like to say that the UK fabrication network, and certainly through the BCSA membership, we've got the capacity and the capability to supply this. But for some reason, the government aren't seeing the public procurement purse all the way down the various tiers in construction in order that we can maximise the wealth creation and also in, you know, it's National Apprenticeship Week, the job creation in the UK.
Now,
you know, it's absolutely critical. We need more young starters coming into this industry.
Jonathan, we've got in Bill somebody who's trod this path before in a very specific sense and won. So if you want to hold up this document and maybe explain to everyone listening and watching how this actually came about in the offshore wind sector specifically.
Okay. So basically, the offshore wind sector many years ago was inherently manufactured in Denmark. It was then transferred across to the likes of the UK, and then those items would be a foreign vessel that was going to be installing it, probably Saipem, the Italian side of installation. Then it would be foreign labour that would be then actually, you know, getting the thing to work, installing it and doing all of the on-site work as well. And, you know, we thought that actually that's not right. You know, there's a what we need is for the UK to have strong manufacturing roots to be continuing for many, many, many years, and we need work to be able to take those people on, to the youngsters I'm talking about, to be able to, you know, create that manufacturing longevity. Now, that's why we then decided to write this in conjunction.
2018.
Yeah, 2018. But the government listened, and if you look, you know, fast forward now to where we are now, There's a plethora of large offshore projects. See a Wind investing, billions of pounds
on the Humber. There's billions as well
in on the Humber Teesside. So that the amount of work that's going to be coming through from that alone, just on the offshore wind side, is phenomenal.
So just before we go to Jonathan, just to explain, I got involved in this as well. So full disclosure, we got a former energy minister to go and look at the capacity of the UK sector. He wrote a report. You submitted the report to government and pushed hard, openly. Secret. Media were told. No behind the scenes lobbying, very upfront lobbying. And you persuaded the government to introduce a recommendation for what they call local content. I don't mean local to Teesside, I mean local to the UK.
Yeah. So what we pushed for there was a 60% local content. And we wanted it for the manufacturing, not just for the installation and the longevity of looking after these things, because that would take a small number of people over a number of years. But we wanted it on the manufacturing, which we think is really, really important. And, moving on from that, so that was local content for projects that were normally the developers are from Europe, for example. So we needed to make sure that the UK got its fair share of that market.
And the argument was that these developers were being given permission to use the Crown seabed, so the public owned the seabed.
Yes, the
UK.
Correct.
And so even though the government wasn't directly contracting, the government could have a say in what the developers did.
Yes, indeed.
And that was the argument. It has come about. Now, Jonathan, you're, I suppose, taking that argument and now extending it to other areas of large government-supported projects.
Absolutely, yeah. I think we certainly saw on HS2 some infrastructure and bridges in particular, which were perfectly capable of being manufactured and installed from UK organisations. And as you mentioned before, there's also the growth in both onshore and offshore wind, which are very dependent on steel structures. And we feel that there is you choose my words carefully. There's certainly the opportunity that it's going overseas when it could in fact be done by UK companies. And as I said before, you've just got to look at it that it's, it's the UK taxpayer money, and it's also an opportunity to create more wealth than's being spent through job creation and taxation.
And by the way,
to your original point on taxation. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And Bill, you aren't saying they have to be British companies, but for instance, CR Wind isn't British, it's South Korean. About them investing and making and having activity here.
Yeah, and to be fair, CR Wind, they were very, very proactive. They're talking about people from Teesside and the wider Northeast, and they've got a lot of active promotions for apprenticeships, using all different colleges and such like. They're looking for managers and engineers. And yeah, they're going to want, I think, 750 people, I think was mentioned. And then on the same side, you've got BP, of course. BP, they've contracted out to Balfour Beatty and Technip. And to be fair to, absolutely be fair to BP, Technip and Balfour Beatty, they're all pushing for local content. Now local content to me is anything within the UK, we don't have the amount of skills that we actually need. We need to be pressing for apprenticeships. We've set up an academy to do that ourselves, along with the colleges as well. But, from my point of view, we have to do more. I see some companies, taking these apprentices on, and yes, it does cost money, but I think if you don't take them on, you're going to fall by the wayside. You need to smell a coffee, wake up, and start taking young people on.
So I suppose, Jonathan, you'll regard it as a success if in 5-10 years time, or certainly 5 years if Ed Miliband was getting it to his target, a newly decarbonized grid had electricity pylons built in Britain. That's what you want to see.
That's what we'd like to see, and I think that's perfectly possible and capable to achieve. And I think, you know, the other part is, you know, that people maybe have a view of both the steel industry as a whole, that it's, you know, it's pretty antiquated. And I think from what you've seen there from Bill, you know, and what you see amongst our membership is actually a lot of investment in people and machinery environments. And, you know, the rise of organizations either having a very close-knit relationship with tertiary colleges or having their own academies on site is increasing. Well, because I think you're absolutely seeing the need to invest.
Jonathan, thank you for joining me. All power to your elbow. I'm sure that listening to what Bill has said, you could, and it could be done, that because it succeeded, didn't it?
Yeah, so be in touch, Bill.
Yeah, I'm sure you will be.
I don't think the people generating electricity particularly liked it. That's another matter.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for joining us in the studio, Bill. Before we go, I want to finish because recently I spoke to another person, but not a UK manufacturer, an Italian manufacturer. Fabrizio Casoli is the head of Ducati, but in the UK, he's got a great passion for motorcycles and he's growing the Ducati brand here. Welcome to the Northern Business Podcast. In this edition, I'm talking to Fabrizio Casoli. Fabrizio is the managing director for Ducati Motorcycles here in the UK, but also in Ireland and some of the Nordic countries of Europe as well. Fabrizio, welcome to Northern Business Podcast. First of all, tell us about your background. How did you come to end up in the job leading Ducati in the UK?
Passion for motorcycle, first of all, that made me become a mechanical engineer and straight into Ducati to work over there in Italy. Then in Asia, where I lead a development of the business to get to China, for example, up to a business that has generated half a billion in 10 years. And then after that, back in Europe, in the UK, where I have a family, my wife is British, and where there is great opportunity to put my experience of the past in Asia here and develop this country.
Now, Ducati is one of the great motorcycle brands. It's got huge tradition behind it. I understand it's celebrating its 100th anniversary next year.
Correct. So it's not a young company. It's starting a long time ago, not necessarily in producing motorcycle. They came later. But next year, 2026, we will celebrate our first 100th anniversary. All driven by passion and driven by fantastic, excellent products.
Here we are in the UK with huge motorcycle heritage, the great names of UK motorcycles, the Enfields, the Triumphs, the BSAs, and Ducati, the Italian, you know, a bit of an imposter, are you? Is it something that is new to Ducati, or is there already an established market for you?
It's an established market. Ducati's been in the UK for almost 40 years, so we're talking about a long time. The motorcycle community sometimes goes beyond the national borders. It's an international community. We have a lot of enthusiasts, a lot of Ducatisti here. Just to give an example, the largest Ducati club in the world is here in the UK. So number one is here in the UK. And that is our job to have a client base which is enthusiast and loyal to Ducati.
Now, the Ducati product is in the higher end of the market when it comes to motorcycles. It's seen as, maybe I'm right, a Porsche, if it was a motor car. Where would it sit if it was
There are different point of view. Some people say the Ferrari of the two wheels, some other the Lamborghini of the two wheels, because being part of the Audi group, we are both companies belonging to Audi. But yes, the Porsche is a very good example, because also Porsche belong to the same group. So.
Okay, now let's talk about your investment plans in the UK. You've sold bikes here for 40 years. What does the future look like?
The future is looking positive for us, because we have a number of elements that makes us think that it can be very positive. We are investing on the Ducati network. These will be supported by, of course, by the products that will be produced by the factory in Italy.
Now, I know that the network is very important to you and you want to see modern outlets, and you've pioneered that in Northeast England. Tell us the type of outlet that you've produced there.
You mentioned North East England. Sunderland, Ducati Sunderland, is the our latest new dealer. It's the place where exceptional product needs to be presented to our clients. So if the product is not in line with the environment in which the product is being portrayed, there is a disconnection that our client or our prospect would feel. It's not just a matter of the product itself and the box in which it is, but also the people inside, so the service that these people can produce. And this is a big part of the investment.
So the dealership itself, I suppose, looks more like, in motorcycle terms, the equivalent of an Apple store would be in high-end hi-fi or podcasting or gadgets. It's got a real sense of presence.
Yes, it's very important to not to create a disconnection, as I mentioned before. A disconnection. A fantastic product needs to be presented in same level environment. We can make another example. If you have amazing food in an okay restaurant, you perceive a disconnection. There is something not right. Or even if the food is fantastic, the restaurant is very nice, but the service is not good, then again, you feel this kind of disconnection. Our job is to bring everything to the highest possible level for all our clients.
What about the products? They're seen, as we said, as a high-end product. Are there enough high-end product purchases in the UK to make it viable?
Yes, but this one is never enough. Second, you cannot focus only on one specific segment or one specific product. That's why Ducati is putting his know-how and technology, that, by the way, derives from racing, into all his product range. Enlarging as much as there is a business viability as possible in the product. I give you an example. We are entering from 2025 in the motocross world, which is a new venture for us. Some might think, why would you do that? There is already quite strong competition, but the competition is part of the passion that Ducati is made of. So where there is competition, there is motivation and strength for us to go. So that is one example, but also enlarging the base of the product more in line with the need of the moving need of the customers.
Finally, do you still ride?
I do, not as much as I would like, but I do.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
That was me talking to Fabrizio Cazzoli earlier this month. Now, if you'd like to join us as a guest on the Northern Business Podcast, do get in touch. Best to get in touch with LinkedIn, through LinkedIn, Recognition PR. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks to my podcast producer, Alex Dryden, and the technical operator, Robin Campbell. Join us next time for the Northern Business Podcast. Never miss an episode. Like, subscribe, and rate on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts.